And welcome to the Pedal Revolutionary Show. Today is Thursday. It's Alternative Thursday. And we are here in the studio at CITR 101.9 FM. We caught the bus today. It was exciting. Was it exciting for you?
It was terribly exciting.
It was terribly is is a welcome adjective to combine. It was exciting in a kind of terrible, interesting, and instructive way. I guess. Go ahead.
Was it good for you too?
It was all right. I mean, it's always educational. It's hard to be at the control of other people's schedules, in you know, especially for like last minute lachance like me. My name is Ifni. I'm going to be your host today, as usual, and we're going to be doing another installment of the investigation into the unfortunate fare raise and some of the alternatives that we could, as a revolutionary society here in Vancouver, pursue, such as free transit fares. So we'll be talking about that a little bit later in the show. We've got Dave Olson, who's been doing a five-installment investigation into the viability of free transit on the Taiyi. If you want to go over and check out some of those articles while I'm blabbing away, go to http://thetaiyi.ca, which is a fantastic little newspaper if you're interested in online alternative news here in the Lower Mainland. Also in the studio with me, as usual, hunched over the board like a very focused handsome troll. Hi, David Ripa.
Hello.
How are you?
I am good.
You biked today.
I did, because I knew that you would be late with the bus that you selected.
Really? You are certainly all-powerful and sometimes right.
You can use the word wise. It's okay.
Okay. All right. Sure. I'll use that word since there are people listening. How was your bike ride?
It was good. A little light misting of rain made it even that much better because it cooled me down.
Yeah, because you were riding pretty fast there on your celeste green Peugeot.
Peugeot?
Oh, sorry. It's not a Peugeot. It's a Bianchi.
There you go.
Yeah, sorry. Whoa. I did a big faux pas. Big faux pas and fittingly a French word. And my colleague on the bus today is I'll give you a little bit of an introduction. She's just she's freshly in from Morocco, and she's en route to Thailand, so she's decided to come in and bless us with her presence for an hour, rush hour. She's a writer, teacher, award-winning potter and artist, and she's also the woman who gave me birth. Her name is Rochelle Lachance. How are you doing?
I'm doing mighty fine. Yeah. Thank you very much.
How long has it been since you've been in Vancouver?
It has been 1 year and a half.
Is the city better?
The city has lots of construction going on. The city is always better than it was when I was here last time.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And the toilets are certainly, you know, to be desired.
Yeah, I guess you prefer Vancouver toilets to Moroccan toilets?
I do. I prefer the Vancouver porcelain throne. Indeed, I do.
Right. Worshipping it. So I just wanted to say to everybody, speaking of toilets, I have to go to the bathroom really badly, and I'm not going to. So if you hear my teeth floating, that's what that sound is. I'm also going to be completely unprofessional throughout the entire show and chew gum while I'm talking to you. Do you know why it's college radio? What do you want to say, David?
We do have a four-minute song that, I mean, if you run, you'll make it.
I don't think I'm in any position to run.
Oh.
And I don't need to run. What's running? I mean, I'll be fine. I used to be a tour guide. I've got a bladder like a whale. It's all good. Anyway, yes, do you want to say something else?
Well, yes. I've been searching for something, and I think I found something, so I'll get over what I have to do right away, and that way we can talk about buses as much as we want afterwards.
Sure. Go ahead. Show yours.
Today is also an interesting day because talking about giving birth and stuff like that. It's my father's birthday.
Happy birthday, Daddy.
The man who gave birth to you.
I don't think he gave birth to me.
In a manner of speaking.
Yes, in a manner.
Engendered.
Yes, that's true. And it's kind of odd that this year that both my mother and my father's birthday fell on radio days. So
I think they planned it.
I think so,
Glory hounds.
They knew. So I was looking high and low for some music for my dad for his birthday because I know he's a big fan of Teresa Brewer. He's part of the Teresa Brewer fan club, which
really?
You can actually see at teresafans.org.
I can hear all the clicking of mice out there.
Yes. So we're going to try something. I'm going to try playing it off the internet.
Whoa!
And I think it's just a sample, or else, you know, tons of people would flock and take this and BitTorrent it all over the world. And Teresa Brewer, which I don't know if she's dead or not. I don't think she is.
She looks pretty healthy there on the screen.
She does, yeah. So we're going to try something, okay? Hang on here.
Everybody sit tight. Hold the hands of someone sitting next to you.
Oh, there we go. That's the one for you, Dad. And so there is some music from Teresa Brewer for my father, and I can just picture him in Campbellford, Ontario, singing along as he normally does with this song.
Happy birthday, Mr. Ripa.
Happy birthday, Mr. Ripa, and many, many more.
There we go. So, yeah, we're going to be talking a little bit later, like I said, to Dave Olson, and about transit and things like that. Do you want to give us the skinny on... well, first of all, I'd like to ask you about your experience with cycling, because ostensibly this is a cycling show. When did you learn to ride a bike?
I was a relatively late bloomer with the bicycle, and because I was very attached to my roller skates and my scooter. But, yes... my little red scooter.
And you grew up in Toronto.
I did, and I used to scoot through the laneways of Augusta Avenue. And there are lots of merchants there from all over the world, and as you scoot through the laneway, this one gives you a pickle, and that one gives you a cookie, and this one gives you a slice of bread. Eat, eat, come on, eat. You got two hands. You only need one for the scooter. So that I was very attached. And I came to the bicycle when I was in grade 5, and my cousin Sandy bestowed her bicycle to me, a beautiful bicycle, and my daddy taught me to ride. And when he let go of the bicycle, I went down the hill, and the bicycle turned the corner, but I unfortunately did not.
Mm.
Yes, and badly skinned my knees. I have the scars to show you later.
So he didn't give you like a physics rundown before you got on there?
No, no, he didn't want to impede me learning, you know, learning curve.
Right, the kinetic kind of, he just said, here, go for it.
That's it, that's it. He said, I won't let you go, and then he did.
Were there any rules that you had riding bikes as a kid, like you weren't allowed to go on certain streets, or what were the regulations like, do you remember, if there were any about wearing helmets or anything?
No helmets.
Okay, you could not wear a helmet, I think, is it?
Yes, you could not wear a helmet, but we always had to signal. Hand signals were mandatory, and my parents followed me, running along behind me, just to make sure that I would signal. So we always signaled. I never saw anyone else signal, however. And
your parents should have run after them. That's why. That's enforcement for you.
Indeed, indeed, yes. Well,
so did you continue on riding through your teenage years, or do you remember when you kind of, or if there was a point where you moved on to other things, and then, because I know you did come back to it, so... Tell us about your process, Rock.
My process. Yes, I was sort of the last kid on my block to give up the bicycle. And it became unchic to ride a bicycle in those days. So everyone schlepped their books on their backs. But I continued to ride with the bicycle, much to the mocking of my peers, or mocking by my peers. I rode a, you know, bicycle of a different color, as it were. I came back to bicycle riding in Japan when my kid bought me a mamachari.
Really?
Yes, yes.
I think there's a story connected to how you got that bicycle. And we should also say that mamachari is... charinko is a Japanese word for bicycle. They also call it a jitensha. So charinko and jitensha. Chari is short for bicycle, so mamachari. Mama, same as in English, it's a borrowed word. And a mamachari is a typical shopping bike that people have. Usually they have one speed. Sometimes you can occasionally find one with three speeds. And they typically have a basket on the front and usually a rat trap on the back. All the typical lock on a Japanese bicycle is the kind that goes around your wheel from underneath. It's got a little kind of slider and you just put it around. You want to say something, David?
It's a handcuff lock.
Whoa, really?
I just made that up, I think, but it sounds like
it makes sense.
It's like a handcuff.
Yeah. Okay. So it has what we would refer to as a handcuff lock in the industry, in the radio industry, in the college radio industry. I'm chewing my gum here. There we go. Everybody just kind of locks. It just slides shut, and then the key pops out. So it's very convenient. Although there is a lot of bike theft, it doesn't tend to be professional bike thieves. It's usually people coming out of a bar at 4 in the morning and they find a bike that's unlocked and they ride it home. Although there is certainly a lot of bike theft in certain areas, particularly in, what was the prefecture?
Setagaya, because
the one outside where you first lived in the countryside, just outside of Tokyo.
Prefecture of Tsukuba, because the trains stop about 11 o'clock at night and people have no way to get from the train to home, so they just kind of borrow a bike.
Mm-hmm. So that's a typical mamachari. Also, there's a lot of with mothers. That's usually their transportation with young children. They'll put their little kids in a little seat on the back of the bike, and sometimes on the front too. And that's another reason. That's why they're actually called a mamachari.
Yes, indeed. And Tokyo, being the largest city in the world, has a lot of people using the public transportation, which is excellent, by the way. But riding a bicycle means you don't have to join the 2 million other people a day going through such places as mm-hmm. Shinjuku. And I would like to say also, in between those two places, I did an awful lot of mountain bike riding in the Yukon Territory. Absolutely beautiful land, as you may or may not recall, Ifni.
I do remember, yes. One of the other things... and so about your bike that your daughter got you, I believe
yes.
It was a 3-speed mamachari, which are highly sought-after items
yes.
because they're very hard to find.
They are. And in fact, as I toured the world, I bring that bicycle with me.
Really? So
yes,
you brought
I
that
do.
Bike to Morocco. That's so weird. I mean,
but
I'm
weird,
happy
but
with
wonderful,
it.
Yes.
Well, all right. Fair enough. And in Morocco, what's the deal with bicycles? Do they have bike lanes and... bike parking, and what's the
deal with
what's
bicycles?
It look like?
Well, yes, they have them, and yes, they usually have two wheels,
mm-hmm.
and
makes sense.
And the roads do have two lanes, sometimes one lane, and as with the car drivers, people pay absolutely no attention to those lanes. Morocco is a land of very varied geography, a lot of mountains, and you'll see many bicyclers. Or bikers, as the case may be, biking up and down these mountains. A lot of people come to Morocco to train for the Olympics because the air is quite thin and the topography quite challenging. And so they build up a great resistance and a great strength. And as I'm driving past them in my Peugeot.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right. thank you for reminding me of my on-air flub, but please continue.
Yes. Well, that's what a good mom does. Be supportive.
Uh-huh. And re-supportive.
Yes. I'm just amazed. I have a friend whose kid visited her, and they drove their bicycle from Casablanca to Ifran, which is a university town. And by car, that's a 5-hour trip. So it was pretty amazing. And she said that the drivers were very courteous.
Mm-hmm.
So bicycling in Morocco, it's alive and well. And I just would like to say I didn't want to slam the toilets of Morocco, that the Moroccans are great practitioners of recycling themselves. So your toilet in Morocco is not only a toilet, it is also often a shower. And so you...
Wait a minute, you shower in the toilet?
Yes, you do.
Like inside the toilet? Please, for people out there who have imaginations, we have to help them.
This is probably scaring my father.
This is not a pleasant image.
The toilet being a hole in the porcelain hole in the ground with grips for your feet to stand on, and mm-hmm. then the shower head is attached to the wall beside you.
Okay, so the toilet and the shower share a drain.
Yes.
Would
it
be fair to say that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, it is very fair.
We should actually maybe expand our mandate of the show, so we should do a bicycling, transit, and toilet show. What do you guys think?
Well, I think that'd be wonderful. I know... growing up, my father was very critical of washrooms, and if mm-hmm. it wasn't long distance, I'm sure he could join in on this conversation.
Mm-hmm. Well, and he's free to call in. If anyone else would like to call into the studio, it's 604-UBCCITR. If you have any questions for us about toilets or bicycles, or Morocco or Japan or Peugeots or what?
Oh, nothing.
Okay. Or nothing. If you have questions about nothing, you can call in. I mean, everybody has to go, right? Maybe our mandate could well do with expansion. And we could probably find a lot of solidarity. Anyway, let's go to a song. We're going to listen to a song that will serve bicycle and bus riders very well. It's called The Black Rider by Tom Waits.
Down in the web of the black spider.
And welcome back to the Pedal Revolutionary Show. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. I'm joined here in the studio today with David Ripa, my mother, Rochelle Lachance, and David Olson, who's on the line with us. Hello, David.
Hey, Ifni, how are you doing?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Yeah? Well, I'm really glad that you could join us today. I've been reading your series on the Tai, and I think it's really fabulous, and some really astounding information in there. I just wanted to tell listeners out there just a couple of little tidbits here. You say, for example, things like, back in 2001, when TransLink removed all of the old fare boxes from our buses, if instead of installing the current ones, they simply converted our system to a free fare system, we would have saved a minimum of $240 million.
Yes.
That's a lot of money, David. What would you do with $240 million if you were TransLink?
Well, I would buy lots of buses, that's for sure.
Weird.
Yeah, TransLink has been promising new buses since they became TransLink, and they've raised fares three times, and they're about to raise fares, as I'm sure you're well aware, a fourth time, and every time they raise the fares, they promise to buy more buses, but they still haven't added any buses to our transit system in 7 years, so we've added, there's been millions of new riders, but no new buses.
Mm-hmm. And I guess one thing that I'm always struck by is how much money they actually spend on the infrastructure to enforce fares, you know, with the new fare boxes and things like that. There was a quote here that I ripped off of your, I'll totally attribute it to you, from one of your articles, and it says, the new electronic fare boxes cost $21,500 a piece. To the tune of $27 million to outfit the entire fleet. Just this one-time cost alone added up to 50% of the cash collected by these fare boxes in 2006. So that was the equivalent of 58 new buses. I love how you've done the math.
Oh, thanks.
I mean, so they're spending all this money on infrastructure to enforce the fares, but very little on buses. So what I want to ask you is TransLink from Mars?
Sorry?
Is TransLink, yes, you heard me right. Is TransLink from outer space? Did they come from another planet? Have they taken over our transit system?
Well, you know, the CEO is coming from a place maybe not quite as far, but her name is Pat Jacobson, and it's not a personal thing at all. She was hired because she helped create the very first privatized highway in this country. The 407 highway north of Toronto. So that's what she does. She privatizes things, and that's where her forte is anyway. And so when you look at what TransLink does from that perspective, from a perspective of trying to privatize our public transit system, the things they do actually start making sense, at least to me. Mm-hmm. As little as I know about privatization.
You mean make sense in a logical progression, or make sense as in, yeah, that sounds like it's exactly what we should be doing?
Well, make sense in a logical sense, like, you know, raising the fares constantly and not buying mm-hmm. buses. Like, raising the fares, what they're trying to do is be able to get people used to paying a large amount of money to take a bus and SkyTrain. Mm-hmm. And if they can get that fare up high enough so that a private company is interested in buying it, then she's going to have succeeded, essentially.
Really?
In privatizing the system. Well, going back to your original question, are they from Mars? I mean, if I don't look at what they do from that kind of privatization lens, mm-hmm. then I'm totally with you, because what they do really doesn't make a lot of sense, mm-hmm. because people don't want to have to drive. Mm-hmm. Like, I haven't talked to a driver that wants to drive. You know, mm-hmm. they given a choice between getting to their destination
conveniently and easily and quickly.
Yeah, just as easily, just as quickly, and the same immediate cost, people would take the bus if it was equal.
Well, and it's really funny, too, because whenever we get bike traffic reports in here, it seems to be consistent information that the drivers all look quite unhappy, and it's not an interesting thing. I used to drive for a living, and I was happy driving because I was being paid, but for everybody else on the road, it stinks.
So, nobody gets paid to drive. Yeah. I mean, very few do out there, so...
So I guess we can kind of, we don't have to rule out my theory that they're Martians for the time being, because it is still a possibility. I want to ask you about a term that I think is really interesting, and it's the term non-zero. And it goes back into, there's another little piece that struck me, or a little line here. It says, be aware that when one moves the price of something to zero, in addition to challenging capacity, one is stating that the product or service is not an economic good. That is, that it has no value, warned one transit official.
Yeah, it's amazing, eh?
Pricing signals value. What was it, a transit official from the area or another
city?
No,
that one was from Toronto, from the TTC. But yeah, every transit official I talked to in this province had the same bias and the same ideology. So it's just so unfortunate that the people we hire to build roads and bridges, highways and bridges, are not those people. Mm-hmm. and the people we hire to build transit are not the people that we hire to build roads and bridges, because they have no problem building billions of dollars of infrastructure without putting a fee on its use. Mm-hmm. But transit folks apparently just can't fathom the idea, at least in this country, of creating a transit service that's public, that we all own, and not charging a fee for its use.
I'd like to ask you how long this has been the direction of TransLink, and how long this has been maybe the direction of other transit companies, both public and private, and public-private partnerships.
Great. The direction of privatization, or?
Yeah, just this. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, again, I think since TransLink's inception, they've really been moving in that direction. I don't believe Pat Jacobson has been the CEO the entire time, but there's only one or two years where she wasn't. And I'm quite certain that she was appointed or hired with that perspective and with that desire. You know, it's really their entire life, because they haven't been alive that long. Before that, they were the BC Transit. They were called BC Transit, and they were the Greater Vancouver Transit Authority. So, it's really unfortunate. It's not so obvious, because it's a public transit service. They have never done anything that's clearly spoken to say that they're going to privatize the system. Mm-hmm. But there's been little things that they've done, like the shuttle, the community bus shuttles. Mm-hmm. That they've created that and made another subsidiary, and the union for that, I'm not actually sure that they're unionized. I should have checked all these facts. Mm. Sorry.
That's okay.
Because it wasn't part of the series. But
we make lots of stuff up, Dave. Don't worry about it.
But those drivers do not have the same contract as conventional or larger bus drivers. Mm-hmm. And they really don't have a whole lot of protection. And their days are split. So they work in the morning, and then
right,
they work in the evening. So they really don't have a very good job in general, especially compared to conventional bus drivers. And I want to say that subsidiary has been privatized, mm-hmm, but I can't say that because
okay,
I'm not sure.
Well, and I think what's really interesting here, too, speaking of unions, we talked to the Bus Riders Union last show, and they were, I mean, it's really interesting to see how they are kind of filling a bit of a void as far as going out and finding out what the average person's experience of the transit system is. I mean, they ride the buses, and they collect data on you know, out in the field, as it were, and it strikes me that TransLink in many ways is very out of touch with what the needs are of its everyday users, and I find that unfortunate. I was struck by another statement that you had where you talked about even with the higher cost of fuel today, taking the bus and SkyTrain is more expensive than driving for most families. That's really astonishing.
It I is, think. I know. Well, I referred to a family in Port Coquitlam. They're my family, and they came in to visit and.
That must have been convenient for research, but please continue.
Yeah, but they said, oh, yeah, you can use our example. Yeah. And they're three young boys and their mom, and they came in to visit myself and my daughter, and they spent $26 for day passes. And if they had spent just the one-way fare in and then the one-way fare back, they would have spent $27. And she said to me, like, you know, this is way more expensive than what I would have paid if I had driven, mm-hmm. like, without question. I mean, of course, she's not factoring in insurance and capital costs.
Parking.
But parking where we were going, mm-hmm. of course, it's still free in many places of the city. And the fuel cost is not nearly that high, and the maintenance cost would have been quite negligible for that one trip. So it's not surprising that most people, the vast majority, like 80% of the people in this region, drive, because mm-hmm. it's the cheapest thing for that kind of distance. Obviously, you and I know that biking is easily the cheapest and the most efficient when you're not traveling from a suburb, and even for some it is still from the suburbs, but for most from the suburbs, driving is the easiest and cheapest way to go still.
Mm-hmm. And it's an interesting kind of synergy, right? On the one hand, we have the Gateway project, which is increasing infrastructure for drivers to come into the city. And if a person has bought a car and it has insured it, you know, they've already paid the money and it's sitting in the driveway, and the incentive is very great for them to just continue to use it. And it's a kind of a catch-22 in the same way that the degradation of the transit system is just increasing people's desire to not use it. That's really
absolutely, and that's a really good point that I don't even think I mentioned in the series, is that if people have this asset that's sitting there, they've already paid for, excuse me, and we want people to not use it, we want them to get on transit, then it makes even less sense to charge a fare, because why would somebody who's already paid for something go and pay more money to do the same thing that they could do in their car? Right? It just doesn't make any economic sense. So we really need to get rid of that barrier. We really need to get rid of the fare box, because as a society, there's no question that we want people, if they have to travel those kinds of distances, to be on a bus, not mm-hmm. in a car. Global warming is the ultimate reason. And mm-hmm. if we don't get people, those 80% out of their cars, we're not going to have a planet. Mm-hmm. It's not... Yeah. That's not an exaggeration anymore. So.
The Bus Riders Union also made a really interesting point, and they said, you know, it's like the medical system. We don't really question the fact that we all have access to almost free, or if for people who are below a certain income level, free health care, and yet we question people's ability to get where they need to go for free when that infrastructure could very easily be implemented. I know that I have to ask you this, David. Are you a communist?
No, definitely not a communist. Not that I have anything against pure communism. I've never supported the Soviet Union. It's just another implementation.
So you don't want to put in some kind of iron wall, iron curtain between, you know, drivers and cyclists. And
oh, I do want to do that. I want safe, separated space for cyclists. That's been my mantra for over a decade.
We knew it!
Amsterdam is the ultimate example. I was looking at some stats recently in European countries about modal splits, so the ways people get around in the cities, and Amsterdam had easily the highest. I think it was close to 40% of people traveled by bike, and it was just, it stood out as... it was probably four times higher than many other areas that are bike-cultured. But Amsterdam and the Netherlands have bike infrastructure, and they've had it for 60 mm-hmm. years. Mm-hmm. So it's safe, and it's proven, and it's just part of the whole way of life there. So and it shows in how people get around. Mm-hmm. So,
and you did some research in the pieces that you wrote for the TAI about other cities that have free transit systems.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk a little bit about that? Because there's lots of people out there going, what the? It's impossible.
Where are we going here?
No, but I think for a lot of people, it's really hard to understand how a free transit system would actually work.
Yes, it's true. For me, it was like an amazing epiphany, really, when I took my bike on the 351 to White Rock, paid $4.50, rode my bike across the border, and jumped on one bus that took me from Blaine to Bellingham for 75 cents, and then another one from Bellingham to Mount Vernon for 75 cents, and then I reached the extent of Island Transit, which services Whidbey Island and Kamano Island, and also extends out to Mount Vernon. And I put my bike on that free bus, and it was just a totally different world. It was amazing. There was no advertising on the outside, no advertising on the inside.
No car advertising? Because that's been something that bugs a lot of people when they put car advertisements on buses.
I know. Can you believe that our public transit system is trying to get people to drive by advertising for car drivers?
Cars were very popular on Mars until they...
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. But all the drivers, like every single one, were amazing. And not everyone knew that I was down there as a reporter. And they were all super friendly. I mean, why wouldn't they be, right? They don't have any conflicts about fares. People come on, they love the system because it's free. You just get on and you get off wherever you want. You don't have to worry about change or transfers or anything. It's so simple. And it's well maintained. People really love their system, and it just works so well. The only criticism I have about Island County's system, Island Transit, is that it's not as frequent as it could be. Mm-hmm. So a few people said that, no, they couldn't give up their car yet because it's just not frequent enough. But for commuters to Seattle and those areas, that's where the Island Transit really shines. They meet every ferry, which runs every half hour. They get priority, so they pull up right to where the ferry is, where it docks. Mm-hmm. So people walk 100 meters or so to get on the ferry, and people walk off 100 meters, get on the bus, and the buses offload and load before any cars come on or off of that ferry. So it's safe for people, and transit has total priority. They also operate a van pool system that also has priority. So once the transit folks have loaded and offloaded and taken off, the van pools load on the ferry first. So there's never been a van pool that has missed a ferry. So if you were part of a van pool, you know you're getting to work on time. And they do that from 4:40 in the morning until 11 at night, all day long, a half hour every time. It's a half hour that the ferry's coming and going. So it's just an amazing system where people really are prioritized at long last.
How do they pay for it, Dave?
Well, they have a sales tax, like our PST, that is proportioned off into part of it goes to the state, and the part that goes to the transit system is 0.6%. So if you go to the store and spend $10 on something in Island County, 6 cents is going to the transit system. And that pays for the whole thing. Well, that's not true. They do have some grants that they write or apply for and get, and that mostly deals with infrastructure costs, like new buses and new maintenance facilities and stuff like that. But the operating cost, I believe, is covered by this very tiny sales tax.
And I think maybe what a lot of people don't understand, too, is that car driving is actually subsidized, very heavily subsidized. Do you want to talk a bit about that?
Yeah, well, Todd Littman at the Victoria Transport Policy Institute has done an amazing amount of work and very precise work. And one of the things that I found in my research was that in 2000, I believe it was, the figures that he calculated showed that in Canadian dollars, each car owner in Canada is subsidized by over $5,300 a year.
How do those subsidies play out then? Can you kind of...
Yeah.
Is it with road maintenance? Is it with...
Yeah, well, it's really the difference in cost between all of the billions that we spend on road building, road maintenance, parking, public parking spaces.
Parking enforcement.
Public land, parking enforcement. All of those infrastructural costs compared to, you know, the gas tax, the insurance, the fees that you pay when you buy a car, all those sorts of things that people continuously complain about because they are quite high, but they're still not high enough to actually pay for the infrastructure that's created for everybody to use. So, you know, the Gateway Project is a great example of a huge subsidy. It'll be up to $7 billion if the government ignores all the opposition and pushes ahead, which they won't because we won't let them. But that would just be a giant, giant subsidy. And if we spent that $7 billion on transit infrastructure instead, both buses, SkyTrains, and drivers and people to clean the buses and everything else, it's just the top of my head guess, but that is such a large amount of money that I can't believe that there would be a part of the Lower Mainland that wouldn't have 10-minute bus service virtually 24/7. And all of a sudden, we wouldn't need cars because we have such a great transit system. So we could build more highways. We can twin the Portman Bridge. We can wait a few years until they're more congested than they are right now. We can do all of that and create more accidents, more deaths, more injuries through more motor vehicle use. We can spend that $7 billion that way. Or we can spend it on buses, SkyTrains, and drivers, and get people out of their cars, stop global warming in this part of the world, and save thousands of lives and hospital visits from reducing motor vehicle accidents because people are riding buses. So it's a pretty clear choice for me.
Mm-hmm. Personally, I think it should be mandatory for transit staff to ride the bus to work.
Definitely.
That might be a weird idea. I know in Japan, the train employees, they all get a free pass, and they all have to live on the train route that they work on.
Oh, yeah.
So it means they're really in touch with what's going on.
TransLink employees all get a free pass as well, but the executive, CEO of, Pat Jacobson, they also get a car allowance. So all the vice presidents and the CEO and all those folks, they get a car to use.
Interesting.
So it's not a big surprise that that's where their priorities lie, because that's how they get around still, which is obviously not a good thing. And you've shown that or proven that with the Japanese example. So but back to a comment that you made earlier around TransLink not really and the bus riders union doing all this research and TransLink not really knowing what their customers or clients or what the people that own the system really want.
Mm-hmm.
That was one really amazing find in this research that I did for the series, is that Island County in Whidbey Island and Island Transit, every bus driver counts every person that gets on the bus. They have quite a sophisticated, well, it's not sophisticated, it's just a thing that you...
It's a clicker.
A clicker, yeah, but they have a clicker for every type of passenger.
Wow.
And they just click it. And then at the end of their shift, they transfer those numbers onto a piece of paper and they submit it into the head office. And I saw that every time. And so I trust their numbers. Nanaimo in particular, but TransLink in general, and every system, it seems, in this province, they estimate, and it's really just a guesstimate. And the vice president of BC Transit that spoke on behalf of the Nanaimo system came up with this paragraph or two long explanation of how they estimate their ridership. And what it boils down to is a lot of Nanaimo's ridership pays monthly passes, whether it's through their employer or just on their own. And so that system is saying, oh, look at all these people with passes. Well, they must be using it this many times. And so their ridership is way larger on paper than the Island Transit system. But the population is very similar. Island Transit has more buses, more service, and every bus I saw in the busy times, and even during the day, there was people on every single bus and a lot of people on every single bus. I saw those buses being packed. I've traveled through Nanaimo for years, for probably a decade, and rode buses there weekly. I never saw a packed bus, not once. So that was really interesting. And TransLink's numbers are also just estimates. So
what I want to ask you, too, about that is I know you you talk a bit in your articles about how hard it was to get information about ridership and cost. And I wonder if you want to speak to how disingenuous or if you think TransLink is disingenuous with their figures or if they're intentionally reticent about how much it costs to charge fares. If there is, if they're afraid that if we kind of all put it together in a greater sense that there would be more public pressure on them. Or do you think it's just that they don't collect the information or they're maybe a little bit backwards about how they're collecting it?
I think it's a mix of both. I think that they won't go there, or they have resisted strongly going there, again, because of the privatization perspective, mm-hmm. if that's true, which I'm pretty sure it is. It doesn't make any sense to do that because, you know, I mean, it actually does make economic and business sense because
there's... On Mars.
Well, anywhere in the capitalist world, I mean, you know, any business or co-op or collective that doesn't know how much it costs to collect the money that they survive on, mm-hmm. no, you know, nobody would be foolish enough to just go, oh, well, we'll just try to collect the money and we'll see what happens. No, you look at the system and you see how much it costs, and if it costs too much, you change the system. It's just economic sense, and that's economic survival. But mm-hmm. every one of the 26 systems in British Columbia don't know how much it costs to collect fares, and it's just astounding. So I think for TransLink's case, it's a mix of not wanting to go there, but also just, you know, not bothering.
Not really caring too much because it's not very relevant in some ways,
well,
I guess?
It's our money. It's public money, right? So those folks, it's not their money. So who cares, right?
One thing, I know we're going to have to let you go relatively soon, but I wanted to ask a couple more things from you. And one is about the transit police force.
Yes. Well, that's...
Take it away, Dave.
$25 million over the last 2 years have gone to a bunch of people that have guns and tasers. And why do we need them? They are the very first... such police force in this country. There's, you know, their justification is, oh, there's so much crime around SkyTrain stations. Well, what they're doing is, of course, is enforcing fares with guns and tasers. They're tasering people as well. It's just an absolute outrageous criminalization of people that are doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. I've witnessed a cyclist getting handcuffed with a unvalidated but a paid for ticket. So that's what these cops are doing. And I mean, I'm sure your listeners know very well what cops are capable of and the mindset that they have. People are not given the benefit of the doubt on the system. It's like you have to prove your innocence, and you're guilty until proven innocent. It's just the complete reverse of what the law says, for one, and what we as a society, I'm sure, would want.
Well, and I think we should remember too that they have a very specific mandate, and it's also somewhat contingent on the culture in the VPD. But I do think that, I mean, it's interesting that they talk about safety around stations and things, but that's not where they're spending their time. They're spending their time entering each car of a SkyTrain. They're spending their time going from bus to bus. It sounds like they're going to be on buses now too,
exactly.
And they're actually just checking transit fares.
That's right. Do we need guns for that? The bigger picture is, do police need guns, period?
You know, I have a little thing. It's pay or I'll shoot.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's just how outrageous this is. This is a public transit system. Public. We own it. And they've just put cops and police with very serious weapons that, you know, lethal weapons in our space, in our public space, to punish people, the very, very few people that might not spend the $5 or the $4.50 that it takes to get from the suburbs to Vancouver, or the $2.25 right now. You know, people are getting tickets for $173 because they haven't validated a $2.25 ticket.
One thing I think is really sad is that the discretion of bus drivers is actually being taken away. If a person is either, maybe they forgot their wallet at home and they're on their way to a job interview, or for whatever reason, bus drivers are now not allowed to make those calls because where in the past they would say, okay, well, just this once, they're no longer allowed to do that. And all of the buses and all of the trains have been declared a fare paid zone. And if you don't have a paid fare in your pocket, you are committing an offense.
Right. Yeah.
Wow.
It's so offensive to ride the bus.
Pretty amazing.
Yeah, so ridiculous. I think there's hope in that area, though, because bus drivers were actually never paid to enforce fares. So many drivers are younger and have been trained more recently, and TransLink pushes that boundary horribly, actually. They just you know, get them so rah 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 that it's like, oh no, I want to enforce the fare. Well, no, they're not paid to enforce the fare, and so a lot of these fare conflicts may have been induced by overzealous drivers. I'm not going to comment on that, but mm-hmm. it's their job is simply to inform. It's like the fare is this, mm-hmm. and you know the passenger can do whatever they want. They can pay mm-hmm. or they can get on. So
because it's not like there have been incidents where people have freaked out. On, like, that's not why we're getting law enforcement officials on the buses to protect drivers, is it?
Well, no, that's their rationale, but it's not the reason.
But it's not what maybe is reflected.
What drivers want, and I've spoken to many, and they've said, I want something that's going to protect me. You know, a guy with a gun somewhere else is not going to protect me. A camera on a bus is not going to protect me when somebody's right in my face and angry and have all these other issues that they're dealing with and they're taking them out on me. That's not going to protect me. They want like a shield, a bubble, some sort of thing where they're physically safe and protected so that, you know, they don't get spit on and they don't get assaulted. But TransLink just can't hear that for whatever reason.
And what would do that? I mean, for example, free fares, I guess, would definitely do that. They would protect
Absolutely.
Drivers because they would remove that friction, right?
Well, Island County and Washington State has proven that. Like, they have a great system where if there's a problem rider, the driver has the complete authority to ask them to leave, and if they don't ask them to leave, then they document it, and then the person is banned from the system until they go through a process of reinstating themselves.
Interesting.
And it's very effective, and drivers have a great time. They love their jobs. Two or three of the drivers that I spoke to came from other systems, and they specifically wanted to work there because there's no fare collection.
Hey,
and
Dave,
they said they wouldn't work anywhere else.
Have you gotten any feedback from TransLink about your piece?
No, not yet. No, I hope that they will, but I don't even know that they'll read it. I mean, I've sent it to them directly as well. So, but in 1996, I sent them the first draft of this concept of fare-free transit, and I got no response. And then in 2000, I sent it to them again. I actually was on a CBC show with the vice president, Larry Ward, of TransLink, and he not only didn't represent TransLink very well, but after the interview, I asked him when we were walking out of the building, you know, have you got this proposal, and what do you think? Do you think anybody will respond to me this time? I've submitted it before. I asked him a couple of times with no response, and then he stopped just as we got outside, turned around, and he looked at me and he said, "You're a fucking idiot."
Whoa.
So I wrote
a letter.
So you
have gotten a response.
Harsh. So that was the only response I got so far. And then I sent it to, in 2001, I sent it to all the new board members, and no response.
They didn't even send you that line?
No. I got no response to the letter of complaint either. So it's just incredible. Yeah, the blinders are on pretty strongly.
Wow. Do you think his mother knows that he speaks like that?
Well, I don't think his mother's alive.
You should. That's a really good idea, actually, Dave. You should send your reports to all of their mothers.
Yeah,
I really want to thank you for spending so much time with us today. And my last question to you is, what do you think bus riders and bike riders can learn from each other, in a nutshell?
Can learn from each other?
Yeah.
Well, that's an interesting question. I think we can support each other big time. We're both, you know, doing the right thing, and we're both trying to make it safe and easy to travel and build community while we travel. I think we can learn that from each other. I think bus riders can support critical mass by, clapping when we go by, and I think critical massers can salute the people standing at bus stops when we go by them, because, you know, they're all one less cars as well as us. So,
Did you see in Amsterdam the integration of bus riders and bicyclists? Because when the public transportation stops there, people can get off the bus and they can access a free bicycle, and they then they ride it to a drop-off point near wherever it is that they live. And it's
that's a great point. Really good point. Yeah,
awesome.
Dave,
thank you so much again. And if folks want to look at your pieces, they can go to thetyee.ca and check them out. They're fantastic. And you have a wonderful day.
Thanks so much for having me, Tiffany.
No worries. See you later.
Okay, bye-bye.
We won't tell him that my name's really Ifni. I know that I want to say a couple things really briefly. One is that Car Free Day is coming up this Sunday, Car Free Day Part 2 on Commercial Drive. So the street's going to be shut down again. Fantastic, wonderful event. If you haven't gone, you should go. It's a really good time. Free Geek is going to be there with a booth. And relevant to that, my mother, Rochelle, has brought us a little bit of a ditty from Morocco that that has a lesson in there about how we should live as activists and happy human beings on the planet. Go for it.
So this is a local song from the mountains of Morocco. Les marsta marena kifu keftana. Les marsta marena kifu keftana. Which means, those who don't sing and dance, you got no life.
There you go. So thank you all for joining us. This has been the Pedal Revolutionary Show. Upcoming, we have the stereoscopic readout hosted by Darren G. We're going to go to a little song, fantastic, by the Moldy Peaches called Greyhound Bus. I know it's not exactly the transit system in Vancouver, but it's so exciting and fantastic. Go for it. Right on, and just on one last note, we're going to play a little PSA that we cooked up special. This is going out to Jack Bates at SFU.
It sucks computer waste gets stuck in landfills or dumped on poor countries.
Where can I take my old hardware?
Free Geek!
Is a volunteer nonprofit run by punks like you. Recycling hardware, sharing skills, and providing access to technology.
Check out freegeekvancouver.org or call 604-879-GEEK.
Free Geek, helping the needy get nerdy.
Yeah, this is Mickey Fitz from The Business. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Keep the faith.